Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 31st, 2006. Our session today is titled Stay from Luke 24, 13 through 35. Our Bible study leader is Nancy Winder, session number WIN 2006-01. Let's listen in.
All here. My name is Nancy Winder, and when I'm not at Holden Village, I'm pastor of Faith Lutheran Church in Seattle, and I'm doing Bible study for these next 3 days, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, on it's sort of random gospel selections on three words: stay, abide, and go, from the theme, which is the theme for Matthew 28, I'm with you always for this summer. And so today is for the word stay from Luke 24, 13 and 35, the road to Emmaus. Tomorrow will be on John 15, 1 to 11 on the word abide. And then from Matthew 28, go, you know, the beginning of that, go and make disciples. And then using the Sermon on the Mount for that on Saturday. So today there's other parts that will be with that. I really like hymns, and I really like novels. So I do Bible study with hymns and novels. So we'll do one of those each day as well. It goes with the word for the day and the text. And another thing, I'm also with Paul, Carol, and Tom, the directors of the Village. I'm the teaching staff coordinator, which gets all the program people here, for 2007. And one of the processes we need to be into now is picking a theme for 2007. So at one point, a month ago or so, Paul and I were talking, and we were talking about this text, The Road to Emmaus, that we'll look at this morning, as one thing. So my idea for that was heartburn for a theme. It has multiple uses at any time. But what we'd like you to do is, if, as we're going through these texts, or anything else you think of, if you have any ideas that would be a great summer theme for Holden Village, just write them down. That would be terrific. So since we're a small group, why don't we introduce one another as well? Cliff, do you want to start?
I'm Cliff.
And where are you from?
I'm from a little town called Columbia Station, just outside of Ohio.
Outside of Ohio?
Excuse me. I wake up.
It
Cleveland,
is old,
Ohio.
Cleveland, Ohio. There we go. Great.
Have some more coffee.
Good.
Yeah.
How about
you? I live in Wells, in Des Moines, Iowa, and I'm leaving today.
Okay. Great. How long have you been up here?
Just a week this
just
year.
Just a week this year. Great. Do you come on staff a little bit, or do you?
I have for about 13 years.
Wow.
Until I turned 80, and then I decided I'd come as a guest.
Okay. But I bet you did some work.
Well, a little bit.
Yeah. Sort of part of it. Larry.
I'm Larry Howard. I'm from Seattle.
Nancy Slind from Mount Vernon.
Bob Slind from Mount Vernon. That's north of Seattle, about 60 miles for Midwesterners.
Okay. Eric Holland. Just beginning here as pastor.
Norma, and I'm from Ocotillo, Seattle.
Okay, so the first thing we're going to do each morning is sing a hymn. So we'll do that this morning. And Norma, who's the music director of Trinity Lutheran Church in Linwood, Washington. And we'll sing Stay With Us, which is, I have the number down at one point, 743. In here, it's her brokering text that was it's based on the Road to Emmaus text from Luke 24. And it's a lovely tune. It's easy to pick up if you've never sung it before. It's a very nice text.
Thank you.
Gracious God, on this morning we give you thanks for its beauty. And we invite you to stay with us as we study your word. Open our hearts that we might know how this is the way you walk with us. And we pray that as you stay with us, we may also abide in you. We pray this in the name of Jesus. Amen. Thank you, Mom. The first time I ever sang that hymn, I learned it from Jerry Evenrude, who's a musician in the church. And I learned it from Jerry at a very terrible time when his daughter, Kirsten, had committed suicide. And Kirsten suffered with chronic depression her whole life. And it just got too much for her. And I knew Kirsten and her husband, because when I was pastor here, they were in the high school here. And so Paul called me, Paul Ringo is her husband, and asked me to be with them in this terrible journey. And then her father, Jerry, who's a very wonderful musician in the church, came out, and With One Voice had just come out. And Jerry came in and he said, "We must sing this song because it's perfect for Kirsten." And the way it invites God into our grief is also about the Road to Emmaus story that we have today. That always, whatever the terrible circumstances or the joyful circumstances of life, our invitation for God to come and stay with us and walk with us is what this particular post-resurrection story is about. So we'll look at Luke chapter 24. We'll start with verse 13. And could somebody read the story? It's 13 to 35. This is a story that's unique to Luke's gospel. Sadly, for it only shows up in the lectionary once, and it's not in the Luke series, which is too bad, but very odd. But it's such a wonderful story. Anyway, so what I'd like, if somebody could read it, and if the rest of us, if you're able to listen without following along, just shut your eyes and listen to the story. But who's the volunteer to read?
I'll read it.
Okay, great, and we'll all listen. Thank you.
"Now on that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and talking with each other about all these things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself came near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, 'What are you discussing with each other while you walk along?' They stood still, looking sad. One of them, whose name was Cleopas, answered him, 'Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have taken place there in these days?' He asked them, 'What things?' They replied, 'The things about Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and leaders handed him over to be condemned to death and crucify him. But we had hoped that he was one to redeem Israel. And besides all this, it is now the third day since these things took place. Moreover, some women of our group astounded us. They were at the tomb early this morning, and when they did not find his body there, they came back and told us that they had indeed seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the woman had said, but they did not see him. Then he said to them, 'Oh, how foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have declared. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and enter into his glory?' Then, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all the scriptures. As they came near the village that they were going, he walked ahead as if he were going on. But they urged him strongly, saying, 'Stay with us, because it is almost evening and the day is now nearly over.' So he went in to stay with them. When he was at table with them, he took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. They said to each other, 'Were not our hearts hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road, while he was opening the scriptures to us. That same hour they got up and returned to Jerusalem, and they found the 11 and their companions gathered together. They were saying, "The Lord has risen indeed. He has appeared to Simon." Then they told him what had happened on the road and how he had made known to them in the breaking of the bread.
Thank you. So what did you hear? What's the story about?
Jesus miraculously appearing to unknowing
people.
Jesus is with them.
Grief and disappointment.
Yeah.
On Jesus' part.
No, the disciples.
Oh, all right.
Their grief and disappointment. We thought he was the one to redeem Israel, but he was killed.
They never really got it until he told them. They really never understood what that was all about.
Until he
explained it.
Well, they didn't even understand that.
Yeah. Well, true. They came closer. Yeah.
One would hope so. But yeah, just the breaking of the bread.
Yeah.
It's like a light bulb turning on. And then they thought that.
Mm-hmm. You think we're in the same boat? I mean, great. God is so great. So great. I mean, there's no end to how great he is.
Is there any prehistory to breaking of bread and having wine?
Oh yeah, yep.
Symbology.
Yep. Oh yeah.
So that would have been a totally foreign act to them.
Except he was a stranger breaking bread in their home.
Right, and it's when there's all the connect back to the upper room here too, when he breaks the bread and they know who he is and all that too. Yeah, but then also just in their tradition, yes.
They used a powerful word, to say to Jesus, stay.
Yes, very powerful word.
That jumped out of the statement.
And that's, just moving right ahead here, the word stay in the Greek is meno. This actually connects tomorrow too, because the word abide that John uses all the time is from the same root, from meno. And that becomes the root of a Latin word, manere. That. And where we get words like remain and permanent, manor, mansion, manse, and even sort of down the road ecumenical, right, Paul?
Yeah.
That's meno in the middle there, isn't it?
the
oikomenos is, yeah. Right. Which means, and it actually the Greek word means the from which we get ecumenical means the whole inhabited world. So it's the place where we all live, where we remain, where we stay, where, you know, it's our place becomes that. So, and thinking of this word, when they say stay with us, you know, remain with us, it's like this word meno in the Greek always has this sense of permanence, of continuity. It never... it's not like, well, you know, just stay here for a couple of minutes while I go get the car and then we'll go off to someplace else. It always has a real strong sense of this is the place to be. And that's even more true in John's Gospel. But here also, so when they say, after Jesus has been opening the word to them here on the road, and they say, stay with us, they're already very compelled by what Jesus has been saying to them on the road. So you know it's and so they're also compelling him to say, you know, it isn't just like you must be lonely and it's a long night, it's a, you know, all this kind of stuff. It's like the conversation we've been having is important and we want you to come stay with us with that conversation. What's the time frame of this story? The whole story, from the beginning to the end.
From the time or the
From the beginning of the end of the story.
Well,
Take a look. What's the, what, from all the way from when the when the two are walking, what day is it that they're walking?
Third day.
It's third day. So for us, what do we call it?
Easter
day. It's the evening of Easter, right? So, and they go and they're walking to Emmaus. It's 60 stadia, actually, which is about 7 miles. So they're walking to Emmaus, and but then what happens at the end of the story? Well, Jesus goes away, but then what do the people do?
They go back.
They go back. Same day, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so one of the kind of the fun pictures, I think, of this Emmaus story is of this these two people, and I always kind of like to think of them as, you know, a man and a woman, because that's nice to get, because there's a lot of women around at the resurrection, and, you know, never says that. And so they're walking along, and how do you suppose they're walking when they're going to Emmaus?
Well, all the pictures.
Yeah, right.
The artists.
Yeah, the artist pictures. Yeah.
Aren't they beside a cart or something? Or
well, there's different.
Oh, no,
there's
they're
different.
Just walking.
They're just walking, I think. Yeah. How do they look? Do you suppose somebody want to imitate how you think they're walking when they go there?
Just a long, tall trudge.
Yeah, right. Mm. Do you think they're? I mean, you know.
Not a happy walk.
No, huh? And they're slow, probably. You know, they're in grief. They're sad.
Well,
you know?
It's hot, probably.
Well, yeah, probably hot. Well,
slow down.
But
probably frightened.
Frightened, yes, because they don't know what's going to happen,
yeah,
do they?
Right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so, how do you think they're walking when they go back?
They're probably running.
They're running.
Yeah, exactly. Right. They probably did the 7 miles going back a lot faster than they did going in. So I think that's kind of a fun part of this story, is you've got this image of the people walking along. And with the people walking along too, one of the things I think that this story is about for us, besides being the another way in which the risen Christ was presented to the disciples after, you know, is also, I think it's a wonderful way to, Eric mentioned that, their grief and disappointment. Their disappointment in that Jesus maybe didn't turn out to be who they thought he was going to be, but also just their grief that their friend had died. And they weren't sure about the rumors that were floating around and all this kind of stuff. So, this story's about Jesus appearing to them, but, and, you know, we can say, well, they were kind of dumb not to recognize him. But I don't think so. Think about your own situations of grief in your life. And even the next day or 3 days later, after someone whom you have loved has died, would you expect to see them walking next to you? Would you? No, even if somebody came up who looked like them. You know, if you'd seen the person dead, you certainly do not in any way expect them to be walking along with you. There's no way. Yeah, they might, but I've been a pastor for 30 years and have spent a lot of time with people in grief. And if any of you have been in very deep grief, you know that it's like putting your head in a paper, in a bag or something. You'd see nothing. You hear nothing. I mean, there's only your grief that surrounds you. So it's like I think it's a necessary disconnect that happens when humans are in grief. But there is one with kind of the rest of the world. You know. So I think this is a very normal kind of encounter they have with Jesus. And I think in those days there would have been a lot of people who would have been very intelligent about scripture and things like that too. You know, and who might even have said to them, as we might say to someone in grief, you know, really, it's okay, you don't need to worry about it this way. Just hear these hopes and hear this hope and promise. Even though you may not grasp it right now, but hear this hope and promise. I don't know whether we necessarily say you're pretty foolish about it, but here is hope and promise for you. And I think that's part of what Jesus is doing as he walks along the road. Does that connect with your understanding
of
grief?
I think when we look at this passage, and I've looked at other people. People tend to think of Jesus preaching to them.
Yes.
You know, kind of the
whole litany of stuff.
Yeah,
right.
And I just see this kind of conversation.
It is conversation, yes.
And,
exactly.
You know, maybe just kind of pulling stuff out of them, you know, this kind of give and take.
It does have that in it.
You know.
Well, not only that, but pulling my legs. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah.
He pretends to be going forward, just the way he says, what things?
Yeah.
And he's coming out of Jerusalem. He seems to have caught up with them.
Yeah. So do you suppose he knew they were out there?
That they were running away? Well, for my life, I need this text because this is where Jesus finds me when I'm running away.
Yeah.
Through other people, and they often pull my leg.
So your image of these guys is that they're running away from the danger and the situation and...
Well, the Romans very rarely executed just one person. If there was rebellion, Jesus was being executed for rebellion, which is about the only thing that crucifixion worked for, they take 30 or 40 followers and take care of them at
the same time.
That they didn't do that here is very strange. They may have realized their mistake. The Romans may have.
But
they had every right to run away.
Well, Jesus was, you know, he was only in the limelight for 3 years.
Right.
And he covered a lot of territory.
But did cover
a lot of
territory.
There's a lot of people that heard about him that probably never saw him. Or if they saw him, they saw him from a distance.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody that I met, you know, last year here at Holden, maybe I'd recognize them. And unless they were, you know, somebody that I had interacted with, you know,
yeah, you wouldn't necessarily know that. And Holden's a really good example because especially on the other side, oh yeah, I knew you were at Holden in 1983. So, you know, I mean, Holden has that piece about it. You know, if it's your first time here, you'll find that out. But then there's this deep connect that comes from having been in the same place and understood the same things, which is part of what Jesus is doing with them here. Yeah.
There's also the statement, their eyes were kept from recognizing him.
Yeah.
And he seemed to have known what they were talking about.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So there's a little more than usual going on.
Well, I don't know. I would like to say that their eyes were kept from recognizing him. I don't like to think about that as sort of God closing their eyes to him or something. I'd like to think about that as their grief and disappointment that keeps them from seeing who Jesus is in this particular story. That's my feeling about it, that I like to think about it.
What's powerful for the story for me is putting myself in the place of Cleopas and friend.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, yes, there's this element, and I totally agree with Paul, about fleeing. It's not safe back there.
Yeah.
It's a dangerous place to be. Let's get out of here. But there's kind of a flip side of that for me that, you know, I would also be going, there's nothing left here for me.
Right.
Yeah.
It's
right, that's over. It's over.
And
right.
I remember... reading a long time ago, one commentator's remark that Emmaus was kind of a spa, a rest, and a place to go, a retreat place. And we were looking at this passage a couple of weeks ago, actually, here. And it occurred to me that, you know, when I'm in those kinds of places, you know, I need to go on a journey. I need to get away. I need to... And Emmaus, for me, almost becomes like a Holden village. I mean, a place... I got to leave here. I've got to go somewhere else. It takes some time to get my life together, get focused, and figure out what's coming next. So, you know, I know that's probably not the usual traditional way of looking at this passage, but I see it also as an opportunity to you know, need to go somewhere, different environment, a new place, get myself together, what comes next. You know, is there any truth to all this stuff that I've been learning and following, and or do I just need to go back to whatever it is I used to do?
Was it Dan who said this is Emmaus is a bar? Let's go to the bar.
Yeah.
But it's like and they're not going to nowhere. I mean,
no.
They clearly have friends. They're going to a house they know. They have a plan. It's not like just do that, you know, and it's like, and they know there's going to be a meal there and all this kind of stuff, so, you know, they invite Jesus to join them, so it's good, too. Another piece of the conversation, I think, of the people leaving, there's another piece about that Luke does, because Luke at the end of the section just before this, which is the resurrection story, you know, the women go to the tomb and they come back and the men think it's an idle tale and Peter runs off to go check it out. And then, but these guys are still carrying on the conversation that must have gone on before and saying, you know, some of the women of our party astounded us with the news that this is it, and they're trying to think, well, do you think the women were right? You know, maybe they were, maybe they weren't. We don't know what the story is. So there's this interlock between the whole resurrection narrative as Luke presents it with them. So anyway, so they do know. So they're going to a community they know, and whether it's, you know, the Emmaus Bar and Grill or some other home where they'll be, it's clearly they're going to a place where they know they will be able to be comforted with people they know. It's a journey that has a possible goal for them that will be helpful to them. So I think
they refer to the women that have gone to the tomb as a part of their group.
Yes. Yep.
As a part of our group.
Mm-hmm.
So there must have been some.
Yeah, we get so used to Jesus and the 12 kind of trotting around, but then when you read all through the Gospels, there's just a whole group of people that were all together all the time, men and women, that were the followers of Jesus. That's not make some sense.
Well,
yeah.
Well,
is that my your question?
To
yeah.
Today, you know, is it Lutherans? Is it all Christians? Is it uh-huh. all people?
Probably all the above, huh? All the above, I would think, wouldn't you, people? What if it's a limited group? Is it just limited to their?
But it's
little?
Interesting that Luke writes, you know, that it was a part of our group.
Yes. Yep.
So it wasn't everybody.
Excuse me, I think I missed your point. Wasn't everybody was everybody that was around after the?
That well that
our group.
True.
Yeah,
that's
what I mean.
Well, the Gospels refer to the 70. The 12 are the inner circle. The disciples are kind of the inner circle of the followers, but there's many more.
Oh, and there's just all the crowds that followed him everywhere. Yeah. That's all through Mark now. We're hearing that. And yeah, I think there's just lots of people that were always around. John makes lots of references to Jesus' friends, like Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. And so there's a whole lot that doesn't get written down about people. You know, this I just thought of. I'm going to talk to you about Jameson in a minute, but here's another book. Somebody read, there's a really good book about Mary Magdalene, who's hot topic, you know. Right now. It's called Mary of Magdala. And I'm giving you this recommendation. I generally detest books about biblical figures. Okay, you know, historical fiction based on biblical, it's not my style at all. So I'm here to tell you this is a really good book. Mary Magdalene. And the woman's name is Margaret George. There's also a really good mystery writer called Elizabeth George, and this is not Elizabeth, this is Margaret. This was on the New York Times bestseller list a couple years ago for a few months. And this woman has really done her research, and she's done a very, I thought about this because she's done a really, really good job of setting the scene about Jesus and all the community that was around him during all his ministry. I recommend it, it's really good. And that gets at some of these issues we're just talking about, like who were the people, you know, that gathered around Jesus, and you know, and then there's always the life of Brian. You can always everybody seen the life of Brian?
Yes.
Yeah, right. So you know, which is also actually it's a really good movie about just what we're talking about because you know, like Brian's late for everything, isn't he? He's the 13th disciple, and he's late for everything. So like you know, the Sermon on the Mount, he's way at the edge. What did he say? What did you say? Blessed are the cheesemakers, right? Yeah. So
not only cheesemakers, anyone involved in dairy production.
Yeah, right. That's right. You know, But kind of the good point about the life of Brian is that it is kind of an odd and bizarre picture of that the core group around Jesus was much larger than we normally think of. If you all, an aside, and this is like preaching aside, have you all heard about the life of Brian and why they had to make it that way? About Brian being the 13th disciple, that's late for everything. It's very interesting. The interview with John Cleese of about 15 years ago or something that I saw, and he was talking about this, and he said, they wanted to make a story about the life, do a Monty Python. This is Monty Python. Everybody doesn't know what we're talking about. A Monty Python thing about Jesus. But what they found out is every time they got close to Jesus, it wasn't funny.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't funny. Mm-hmm. So they made the life of Brian about this guy that is always late for everything. And but then John Cleese had a very interesting thing to say about Jesus, which I think does come into our text a little bit too. And he said, I want to be clear that that I'm not saying there isn't any humor in the story of Jesus, or that Jesus himself didn't understand the human part of being able to laugh. In fact, then he had this great comment that said, in fact, he said, Jesus is the most complete human that ever lived, and he's the most complete emotional human. He said, read the gospel stories, and Jesus can, on one minute, be really joyful with one person who's been healed, and without any glitch, turn right around and be angry at somebody else. And John Cleese said, you know, that takes a regular human being 3 days. You know, you usually go off in the other way, the shift from anger to joy or something like that. But Jesus just seamlessly moves from emotion to emotion to emotion. And I thought I find that to be a very helpful comment. So we got into the life of Brian here somehow, but there we go. But we're back to the community that's all around Jesus, of which these two people on the road to Emmaus were a part, as well as clearly, all the people that were, because at the end of the story, when they know Jesus in the breaking of the bread, it isn't just Cleopas and his buddy, right? It's just that they knew Jesus. So I assume it's everybody in the house. So everybody there was part of the larger group, whatever the group did.
You know, that's interesting. For all the years I've read this, I never thought of them being part of a group. That they were just stopping at a wayside inn or something.
Yeah, no, they're going to a house they know. Yeah. And it's like all the pictures, again, that we see, isn't it, of the road to Emmaus. Big road, French countryside, whatever. You know, lots of oak trees. Couple of people walking down the road. That's the one I think of. That's a famous picture. Who did that one? Anyway, you know. But we see two people on the road,
yeah,
and then with Jesus beside them often.
Yeah. I think so much of our, I think so much of my spiritual life, of course, comes from the Word, but artists have done a lot to ingrain my mind with things that I'm not real sure that. You know, when I read it, I'm not seeing that picture. But I also, when I read it, I do see the picture, too. I mean, I can't imagine that it was that. Well, maybe it was that view.
Yeah, right, that one.
Maybe it was.
With the French oaks. Yeah, right, yeah. With Jesus walking alongside. Kind of the robes are sort of flowing, you know. Mm-hmm.
But when I see pictures that Heidi is showing, you know, then I'm not so sure that the road was that beautiful.
What are those? I'm not sure.
Heidi's showing, doing a thing on Israel and Palestine.
Oh, okay. And you see the pictures of how it was, and it probably wasn't quite as attractive as.
But then that's, you know, 2,000 years ago.
Yes. Yeah.
Nancy, there's something interesting in here about the breaking of your bed.
Yes.
That importance of that in, I mean, obviously he didn't just break the bread, but it was it something they had seen before him? They recognized him in the way he broke the bread from before?
Well, there's sort of multiple layers there, isn't there?
Yeah.
So it's either like remembering from some of, they must have been in the upper room, that's one theory, you know, you say, so that when he, the way in which he broke the bread, was it, he took bread, blessed and broke it and gave it to them. So there's four actions you can make good, but the, you know, so it's the whole, the taking, the blessing, the breaking and the giving are all part of it. And so does, and maybe he did he say, this is my body to them? We don't know. Is it implied in the giving? Do they remember the upper room? I mean, there are multiple layers of that.
Feeding of the 5,000.
Feeding, yes, all those places.
The first thought that would come to my mind is the authority with which he did it.
The word that goes with it. Yeah. There's a little poem that's attributed to Elizabeth the First.
Yeah.
Christ was the... Christ was the word that spake it. He took the bread and break it. And what his word doth make it, I do believe and take it. Mm-hmm. You know, which is that, again, and that's kind of that authority piece about the word that comes into this, like you're saying.
Some people just exude that authority when they are in the role. Mm-hmm.
Since, again, we have a whole community of people gathered around here, how about it being all those things? And it may very well be that it is the way in which he took the bread that some people saw, and the way in which he blessed it that resonated with others, and the way in which he broke it that connected with others, and the actual receiving of it, the way he gave it, connected with others.
The appeal to the full range of senses.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And our different ways of learning and receiving information.
And yes, exactly. And isn't it that way for ourselves when we come to the table at the Eucharist, that it's going to be something different for everybody, you know? Mm-hmm. For some people. And in my own community, I learned, now just about my word, how long have Al and Sharon been there? About 12, 13 years now, something like that. We have a couple in our congregation who are, they both have CP, and they're in wheelchairs all the time. And when they first came to the congregation 12 years ago, Sharon said to me, it's really important for me to, I don't just want communion brought to me in the pews, which is what often people do when somebody can't make their way up to the table. I'd like to be able to come. And
this is through her computer.
Yeah, right. She has a light talker. She punches in words. And ever heard Stephen Hawking talk? She talks. She has Stephen Hawking's voice, actually. and so we tried to figure out ways to do that because we have three stairs up to the chancel and stuff like that. And we found out that putting a ramp up, it'd have to go about from our chancel in Seattle all the way to Tacoma, you know, to make the slope work and all that. But so as it was Sharon that came up with the idea, and she said, well, why don't you all just come down to the bottom of the stairs, and then we can roll forward and do that. And so now we do the first table of communion at the bottom of the stairs. And the interesting part about it was that when for Sharon and Alan's sake, we began that, but the first time we did it, all of a sudden we had 12 people up there, you know? Because it was all, like, some of the older people in the congregation who can't do stairs so well, our tradition in our community is to kneel, and they don't, you know, all of a sudden, and of course they would never speak up and say, this is difficult for me. Yeah. But then given the opportunity to do it differently, they all showed up. So it was very cool. But what I learned from that especially, and from other people as well, and especially from Sharon, is that coming for, is that actually making the move to come to the table is deeply spiritual and powerful. To actually stand up and go, even before you get into taking blessing, breaking, and giving, you know, just the action. So there's little pieces of this for all of us, aren't there? That are all part of our own, the ways in which we see Jesus and God revealed in the breaking of bread.
You know, something that just has occurred to me while I was reading this over, and maybe this is very obvious and I've just seen it, but when Jesus talks to them, or when the man from walking along talks to them, who happens to be Jesus, and when he says to them, "Oh, how foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe," etc., and was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into his glory? One of the things that occurs to me is that there's a real temporal sense to this. I mean, it's necessary that the time is involved. It isn't something that just happens overnight. It isn't suddenly Jesus dies and he's right there before them again. There has to be this. There's this gap.
Right.
It's almost, and even when he says to them, you're foolish for not believing this, we don't have any evidence of anybody who was not foolish.
Yeah.
There's nobody that skipped
nobody
along
really
and said, oh, well, he'll be back. This will be, it'll be okay.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's almost like that absence is a necessary part of the revelation that happens, or the completion of the story.
Yeah, no, yeah, yeah, no, it's got to be there, doesn't it? Yeah.
We're all doubting Thomas.
Well, also, and the great part about, you know, all the post-resurrection stories and where, you know, in Matthew, Luke, and John, is that they're it's all very temporal.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, I think it's so important, and this is very important to me. It all happens within real time, real people, real communities, real walking, real humans, real all that stuff. It's not like, you know, I have a family member, you know, it's my extended family, one of my cousin's husband, who's a meteorologist, and he's way into UFOs. And has theories about Jesus coming from another planet. This is all quite serious scholarship, so it's not like woo, although it sounds a bit like that. But he and I—it's difficult to have conversations with him, but I've tried. What's sad in listening and seeing what he's doing is that. It lacks this human connect, this earthbound Jesus, and this resurrection that happens, this death and resurrection that happens, you know, in our dirt, you know, walking on the road with us, and all that. And I think it's just so. I think that's what the gospel's about. That's what God did. You know, that's so. Jesus from another planet, sort of.
Can I throw out another?
Yeah, oh, you bet.
Somewhere here it says, we thought he was the one to redeem Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Israel was essentially a captive state under the Romans. Here comes Jesus, who they probably believe is the Messiah, the one to save them, in the sense, though, that he'll run the Romans off, set up the kingdom of David again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here's somebody that's a social welfare, healthcare system, and can feed the whole population just by, you know, taking a couple of fish.
Yeah, take a collection and pass it around.
Yeah,
right.
You know, I'm just passing it out.
Yeah.
So then he's gone. This dream just burst. You know, he's gone. And here's this guy comes in and tries to explain to them that, you know, what the real truth is. I'm not sure they go back to Jerusalem and say, he's back. you know, but I'm not sure they really get what.
No, I don't think they're probably not quite there yet. No, but it's changing. And where did, and I think in the, that's one thing I like about the Emmaus text, and I think where even their mind starts changing about that is about, is in the breaking of the bread, you know, that there's, that this, that Jesus makes this, I like to personally connect it right back to the upper room, because I think that that making that connection draws them back into what God's intention in Jesus is, and not what their thoughts about who Jesus might have been were. And also that they immediately make the connection from his opening the word to them on the road right after the breaking of the bread. And they say, well, duh, we could have had a V8. You know, I mean, it's like, well, of course. You know, he was talking to us about this. You know, didn't our hearts... One point about the... So anyway, yeah, I think you're right, you know, about where they're going. But it changes, I think, at this point. And so when they, I think when they run back to Jerusalem to talk to the others, there's a shift going on. And one thing that happens at the end of Luke is, you know, Luke writes the ascension in twice. It happens at the end of Luke and at the beginning of Acts. He repeats it. And in Luke, it's where Jesus tells, where the voice comes after the ascension and says, stay in the city until you've received. And then that's, again, like they say, stay with us. It's the same word. Stay in the city, you know, in other words, stick together, be there, and then they'll get the spirit. So I think there's a consistency in Luke about how they're starting to have this opened up to them. There's another interesting word in here when it says that they were, and when he opened the scriptures to them, and then it was at the end, how does that go?
Their eyes were opened,
right. That opened... The word means, in Greek, it means absolutely, completely opened.
And, you know, was this like a light coming on? Is this the work of the Holy Spirit? Is this the same that when Saul's eyes were opened?
That I don't know. But I know that in the Greek, it means completely opened. And the other place where this word gets used, it's in Mark's Gospel, it's in Mark 7, the story when Jesus opens the ears of the deaf man, and he uses the Aramaic word... I can never say that. Ephatha. That was Aramaic. But then Mark writes in Greek it means to be opened. It's exactly the same word that gets used here. And it means completely opened. You know, sort of without block or detriment. It means all the way open. So it isn't like just the door's ajar a little bit, or you got one eye open, or one ear open, or a little bit of earwax out and the rest is left in. But it's everything wide open.
You have no preconceived notions about what you're seeing or hearing.
Exactly, right. You've got clear vision, clear hearing. And that's what this their eyes were open is about here.
What I get a kick out of this when he chastises them. And he says, oh, how foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have declared. In other words, to me, he's just saying, hey, this is all on schedule.
Yeah.
All the events are right in place, and you still didn't pick up on it. You know, and I told you about that. And the prophet told you about that. It's all on schedule, folks.
Making the connection, deal? Making the little connection, yeah. And getting it opened out. I want to talk a little bit about the novel. You know, actually, we have to do a hymn and a novel. We've already done the hymn, now the novel. This is Jane's Land by Michelle Hunabin. She actually writes restaurant reviews for the Los Angeles Times. And I'm offering this up. It's got some sex and bad language in it, so I'll just give you that little caveat. But it's a great novel. And a funny one. And Carol, I think you've read it, haven't you? And I picked it to go with this text because the way the blurb writer, although I believe all blurb writers should be shot just sort of as a matter of course, but on the back, talks about it's about a novel about love, faith, and a few wayward souls waiting for life to begin. But this is a book that's full of invitations from people to stay and people's decisions to stay. It's a about relationships. The main heroine is a descendant of William James, the great educational philosopher in the U.S., and which it has its own, he was big on dreams, so it's got its own interesting thing that way. But it's also a great book about church. One of the other characters is the new minister at the local Unitarian church, and it doesn't matter if you're Unitarian or Lutheran or Presbyterian or whatever, the kinds of arguments they have will be familiar to anyone who has ever sat in a pew for more than about 5 minutes. And the Unitarian minister is not doing well in her congregation, and she's new, and it's kind of a treat. And she's going through all the time, you know, and essentially she always says, you know, they invited me to come be their minister. And is anyone in the room Unitarian, by the way? Unitarian? Is anybody Unitarian?
Close.
We were, okay, but Unitarians are interesting. They're, you know, we talk in, among other congregations, about, you know, like congregational churches being very congregationally based. I mean, Unitarians really are congregationally based. I mean, every community shapes itself. They have some, you know, they've got a ministerial association throughout the whole national organization, but it's, every congregation is really in charge of its own thing. And so they've called her to be their minister, and she keeps saying, you know, kind of essentially, I'm totally paraphrasing here to match this, but they said they wanted me to stay with them, and now they're not, now they're just arguing with me all the time, so then they want me to stay or not. And she's asking, should I stay or shouldn't I stay? And it goes back and forth like this, and this is one little passage from the book. And she has just had her evaluation. And every idea she's had has just been totally shut down. And they basically told her, you're not a good minister for us. But she still has to keep going. So after her evaluation, here's what is written. She spent the rest of the day on her sermon, then attended community meetings until 9:30 that night, all with steadfast good cheer, as if she'd received no mingy evaluation, no expletive deleted on the pledge drive. But then she couldn't sleep. Rising early, she walked through the neighborhood and crossed the LA River to a small Episcopalian church in Atwater, arriving in time for the 8 o'clock communion service. She knelt, took the wafer on her tongue as men and women had been doing for 2,000 years, and briefly was dissolved into a body far greater and more everlasting than her lonesome, besieged self. Knowing Jesus in the breaking of the bread and being part of the community that also sees. Thank you. Thank you.